News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
I am Paul Leffler. Welcome to Hometown Heroes on this Sunday afternoon. The purpose of this show is to honor the men and women on the front lines of freedom around the globe today and in years past. We've been focusing primarily on World War II veterans because of the urgency of preserving their stories for posterity, making sure that our younger generations know about the greatest generation and everything that was accomplished by those 16 million men and women who served in our armed forces during World War II. We've got a very exciting program in store for you today. We will visit with a man who spent 11 months as a prisoner of war, enduring one of the most atrocious and horrifying ordeals that any POWs were put through during World War II. He lived to tell about it, and he'll tell you about it here today. As always, we'll talk about a book of the week as well as a website of the week, and a very interesting locally produced website that we'll talk about a little bit later in the show. Towards the end of the show, we'll also get to your phone calls at 490-5858 and 800-776-5858. But right now, let's meet our veteran who's in studio with us today. Rudy Giannone grew up in Dos Palos, where at the start of the war, his father was the head gardener at Eagle Field. A lot of KMJ listeners familiar with Eagle Field, not even if they're on the west side, but around the valley, because Ray Appleton spends so much time talking about Eagle Field and what they're doing to preserve it now. Rudy, growing up on the west side in Dos Palos, I understand you always had a fondness for airplanes.
I always did, even when I was just growing up as a young kid or teenager. And my brother and I built an airplane out in the backyard, and it was about 12 foot long. The wheels on it had a cockpit in it, had a propeller on it with a crank that would go in the cockpit and turn it around, just like a real airplane. And I was just always interested in flying.
The Wright brothers and the Giannone brothers.
Yeah, right.
And so I imagine as a kid growing up there, when they started constructing Eagle Field, that must have been a pretty exciting thing for you.
It certainly was. At that time, I was working for Southern Pacific Company, and Eagle Field was just, they were just building it down there in Oro Loma, which is 7 miles, about 7.5 miles from where I grew up there. And I saw the cadets coming through there, and they were flying PT-13s. And the two-wing airplane, which I can't even think of right now, it slipped my mind.
Probably had some Stearmans back then.
Yeah, those were great planes.
And then they brought in the Volte vibrators, as the guys called them back then, because they shook so much.
Yeah, they were small, and they were like a little putt-putt, I used to call them. But they did the job.
And you would have a job to do eventually. I understand that when you became that age where you were eligible to go into the service, you had a chance to take a couple avenues that might have been fairly convenient. Some would have kept you right there in Dos Palos, but you wanted to do what everyone else was doing. You wanted to get into the service.
Yes, I did. I could have stayed and worked at Southern Pacific Company there because they hauled a lot of freight for the different services on the railroad. And then my dad was a head gardener down there at Eagle Field, and he says, "I'll talk to the captain, see about getting you stationed here." I says, "No, thank you." I says, "All my buddies are gone, and I want to go with them." So February 9th of 1943, I signed up, and I went to Monterey.
And a little more than a year later, I guess about a year and a half, you're on your way to England to be a left waist gunner on a B-17 crew.
I went in the service when I was 19, and they put me on board the ship in New York on my 21st birthday.
Some birthday present.
Right. It was a English ship, and it was there was about 20 ships in the convoy with destroyers on each side of us, and we took off for England.
And pretty rocky seas.
Oh, the sea was real rocky that time. You would be up on the top of the wave up there at one time, then you'd be down in a gully the next, and it looked like about 100 feet. and then you're rocking back and forth, and your dinner would fall, slide off the table. But we made it through. We landed in Liverpool, England, in about, took about 2 weeks to get there, but we got there.
You got there, and you became part of the 447th Bomb Group, the 708th Squadron, and that was just in time for a pretty important stage in World War II history, the Normandy invasion. That was your first week there.
The first week there that we were there, they told us the night before to go to bed early, because they were going to wake us up at about 2 o'clock in the morning, so that, which they did. And we went in the briefing room, and they told us what was going on, that the D-Day had already started, and they briefed us, and then we took off, and the sky was just black with all the different bombers and fighter planes.
And I imagine you knew it was a big deal at the time, and obviously being your first week of combat, it was a pretty big deal to you. But I imagine that you didn't realize till years later the magnitude of that day and how huge of an accomplishment it was for the Allies to do what they did.
It certainly was. It was a big accomplishment. I know how big it was because we were up in the air. We didn't see what was going down on the ground over there. But we did our job of dropping the bombs where we were supposed to, and flying all those days, and we did an awful lot of flying, and there was so much accomplished within the next few days. It's just unbelievable, and just to see all the airplanes up in the sky, and then knowing what was going on down on the bottom, on the ground down there, it was just unbelievable.
And less than 2 weeks later, June the 18th, your crew gets assigned the seventh mission for you. And again, you're the left waist gunner on the rear left side of that plane with a little window to look out and fire that gun should any fighters come at you. You're headed for Missburg, Germany, between Hamburg and Hanover. And something did not go as you planned it.
Well, we went to bomb Missburg because Missburg was a big oil refinery there. And usually when they have an oil refinery or something big, big factory or anything, they have a huge amount of anti-aircraft guns around to protect it. And the Germans with those big anti-aircraft guns were just as accurate as can be. They would, they knew where you were coming, and they'd take your path, and they'd shoot up. They knew your altitude, so they'd shoot into a box up there, and they would make just like firecrackers going all the way around you, big firecrackers, and they would shoot into that box, and you would have to fly through that to get to your bomb, to get in your bomb run to drop your bombs.
And you really had no choice. Your pilot can't break formation. You have to stay at that altitude. You have to maintain speed.
Yes, you do. And you can't shoot back at those guys. No way. So they hit us in the left wing at the number one engine, and that's when the flight engineer at the top turret gun, he came into the bomb bay, and I went in the bomb bay from my waist gun because I was the other engineer, and we looked through there. The bomb bay doors were open. We were flying up at 20,000 feet. And we looked into the wing, and there's only little holes where you can't get through. And we told the pilot what was going on about the fire in that wing, and the wings are full of gas. That's where your gas tanks are. So he waited a few minutes, and then he says, bail out.
So with the other engines, you could have kept flying, but because that fire was so close to where the fuel was, you were just a bomb waiting to go off.
That's true. It just... You know how gasoline is, and with a fire close by, it can go off any time. So he told us to bail out, and everybody bailed out except the pilot. And I guess he was just waiting to let everybody get out of the airplane, because as I was coming down on a parachute, I was floating down. It was nice and quiet floating down, but all of a sudden I saw the plane explode, the flames got to the gas tanks and they exploded, and the pilot got killed.
So nine men made it to the ground safely in parachutes, and
right.
The pilot...
There was two planes that got shot down that day, ours and another one, and they saw nine parachutes come out of one plane and ten out of the other. So ours was nine parachutes, and the other airplane, every one of them got out.
I'm going to hold you right there. We need to take a commercial break. So we'll leave Rudy floating down with his parachute over Germany as we get to this commercial break. The most amazing part of his story, the 11 months after that as a prisoner of war, are still to come as we continue this version of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty. On 580 KMJ.
One of those everyday Americans who answered the call of duty in World War II was a young man from Dos Palos by the name of Rudy Giannone. If you missed the first segment, we left Rudy in the air over Germany after bailing out of a flaming B-17, watching it explode as he parachuted down toward the German soil. He ended up hanging in a palm tree, or a pine tree, I should say. Hard to find palm trees in Germany, but they did have pine trees. And Rudy would make his way down to the ground. And I guess you had, what, about 3 or 4 hours of freedom before they caught up to you?
I had about 4 hours of freedom. And I hid underneath a bridge most of the time. And I got caught when I came out. And we had maps and a compass. And I wanted to see where I was located at on a map. And when I come out, I got caught by civilians who turned me over to the soldiers, who took me through an airfield nearby. And that's the only time that I was hit by any Germans. It happened where we were going down a hall. I had two soldiers in front of me and an officer behind me and two soldiers behind him. And we came through swinging doors, and I failed to hold the swinging doors open, and it went and hit the officer, and I got cussed out in German, which I didn't know what it was. But anyway, they slapped me silly. And that's the only time that I ever got hit the whole time I was in as a prisoner.
And this is June 1944. Obviously, no one has any idea how long this war is going to go. You don't know how long you're going to be a prisoner, if someone's going to come rescue you, or if you're going to die a prisoner. But they take you to Gulag Luft in Frankfurt, where it was an infamous interrogation center. I've talked to some other POWs who had some horrific experiences there. They were fairly cordial to you, and I imagine it surprised you a little bit when the guy in the German uniform started speaking in perfect English to you.
He spoke as good of English as I did, maybe better. And he wanted to know information, which I could only give him my serial number. And he says, okay. He says, I'll tell you something. So he goes and gets this book. It's about 48 by 48 by 4 inches deep. And he opens it to a certain page. And he says, you were born in Dos Palos. You went to Dos Palos High School. You went to Amarillo, Texas at a mechanic school. And he told me everything about me. He told me more than I knew about me. And then he wanted to know the commander's name in England of our Air Force base there, which I says, I don't know. I haven't been there that long. I never met him, and I don't know his name. So that was it. And I was put back in solitary confinement, which I was in there for about 4 days until they got enough American GIs as prisoners, which then they put us in boxcars, which are, they call 40 and 8, 40 men or 8 horses. And in our boxcars, in our train, they put 60 men in each car, which would have been 15 on each side and 15 back to back in the middle.
And no food,
and
no water,
no bathroom. And no bathroom. And you can make imagine what we did.
And on top of that, here you are on railroad tracks. You knew as a pilot, one of the biggest targets besides oil refineries are marshaling yards where they have trains going in and out. So when you're sitting on those tracks, you might be bombed by one of your own guys. They wouldn't know.
Yeah, that's what we always worry about was either getting bombed or getting strafed by our own people, which fortunately it never happened. We went through all those big, huge railroad yards and got all the way to Poland. It took us about 7 or 8 days. It's been so many years that I can't remember. But anyway, we got to our railroad station in Poland where they let us off. And then from that little station, it was 3 kilometers to the Stalag Luft 4.
Which would be your home for the next 8 months or so.
In the next 8 months, it'd be our home. And it was right in the middle of a fort. It was, to me, the camp was a piece of cake compared to what was going to be coming up.
A piece of cake or a piece of rock-hard bread that you had to slice.
Really, yes. It was, I'll tell you what they gave us in that camp to eat. We had potatoes. In the morning, they gave us hot water, which we made coffee or tea from our Red Cross parcels, which we each got a Red Cross parcel, but we had to split it with a buddy. We had a buddy system. And then for lunch, they gave us... we ate out of our Red Cross parcels for lunch. And then for dinner, they gave us we had a kitchen there with our men working in the kitchens, and they made soup out of potatoes, cow turnips, which were kind of old and they had a lot of worms in it and stuff. But when we got the soup, we just moved the worms over a little bit and ate the rest of the soup.
And if the planes happened to hit a horse outside the camp, you got a little meat in your soup.
When a plane, they came out strafing and they killed a horse, we'd get the horse and it'd be 2 or 3 days or 4 days later. So they'd have to clean it up. And I hate to say this, most of the time they were full of maggots. So when they were putting the soup, you just move the maggots over and eat the rest of the soup.
Didn't have a whole lot of choice, and I know...
That's right.
The bread that they gave you was...
Now, let me tell you about that loaf of bread that they gave us. It was like a brick, the size of a regular size of a wheat bread, but it felt like it weighed like a brick. And it was 30% flour and 70% sawdust.
And you had to cut it.
And I had the honor of slicing that bread, and there was 24 of us in each room, and you had 24 guys looking at you when you were slicing that bread to make sure that they got their regular size that they were supposed to get. So when I got through slicing that bread, I had blisters in my hand because that was like cutting a brick.
And as awful as everything you just described was, I know that you kept a positive outlook. We've talked about that with you, and you kept your focus on getting home. But something would happen in February of 1945 that would probably make it seem a little more like the odds were against you ever getting home.
Yes. The day before, about February 1st, they came over to us and they says, you guys better make up a knapsack out of some underwear or something and put all your valuables in it because you're going to be going out of the camp on a march. So this in Germany was the coldest winter that they'd ever had. And it was snow on the ground. And so February 2nd of 45.
And they needed to make you march because the Russians were getting close to where they were. They didn't want the Russians to liberate the camp.
Right. The Russians were headed west, they were beating the Germans, and they did not want the Russians to liberate us.
So they evacuated some people along the Baltic by boat, some people went by train to Berlin, and you start out marching west,
yes.
Obviously having no idea how far they plan to take you.
No, we didn't. They took us in groups of about 500, the remainder of the people that were in the camp, and start marching us. And I remember the first night we slept in a snow-covered field. There was no place else that we could sleep. And then from there, we would travel about 18 to 25 kilometers a day. And then at night, they put us to rest in a cow barn. And we had a blanket, and we'd sleep on the hay if there was room. Because you figure 500 guys, they split them up in different barns, and you slept wherever you could. And you had no food or water to drink. Anything that you could steal, like an egg or a chicken or a potato. A lot of the guys ate raw chicken, never even cooked them. They stole them, but ate them raw. And I'd heard that some GIs even ate rats that they caught, which I never did.
What kept you going all this time? I mean, you have no food, you have no water. If some guys would stop marching, the guards would shoot them right there on the spot. You saw guys dying every day?
Now, after about a week, the guys, our guys start coming down with dysentery, pneumonia, different diseases. Some even had from the cold, frozen feet, frozen hands. And I think thinking of coming home, that you're coming home, just got you through a lot of this. I know that's what got me through it. I always thought positive, and that helped me get through it, really.
And, you know, we hear about the Bataan Death March, and I've interviewed survivors of that, and it was a horrible ordeal and just a crime against humanity. And the guys that were on that the longest were about 2 weeks marching. Your march lasted a lot longer than that in the snow.
Our march lasted for 3 months, and we traveled over 600 miles through the snow, through the ice, over bombed-out bridges. And we even came close to Dachau, where the Jewish people were murdered in those places. And we had people, now they had a cart that carried the sick, some. But then it got to a point where some of the guys who weren't sick would try to get on the cart, so the poor guys that were sick, we had to help carry them. And then there was some that could not make it, and they were just shot in the back over there and left for dead.
And I imagine you had to feel pretty weak after a while, too. I mean, you lost between 50 and 60 pounds by the time this
was over. When I got liberated, I weighed a little over 100 pounds. So I lost about 170 pounds when I started. So,
we'll get to that.
This was called the German Black Death March. It wasn't as bad as the other, the one in the Philippines, but this was bad.
As far as numbers go, it wasn't bad, but certainly anyone who lived through it saw what you saw. Certainly thought it was pretty bad and pretty amazing for you to make it through that. We need to take another commercial break here. When we come back, we'll wrap up with Rudy and hear about his liberation and his life a little bit since then. And then we'll move on also to our website of the week and our volunteer of the week. And it might be something that's useful for you if you have a relative who was in World War II and you've never been able to get all that information about what your dad or uncle or grandfather did in the war. I think you might enjoy listening to our guest on that. But more with Rudy Giannone as Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Boy, time goes by so quickly on this program as we talk to men and women who know the meaning of those three magic words, to borrow from General Douglas MacArthur, duty, honor, and country. Rudy Giannone knows those words well. He spent 11 months as a POW. We were talking to him about that before that commercial break, and we resume now. And Rudy, I understand you wanted to share a little something about one of the German guards who picked on you and the other POWs in Stalag Luft 4 a little bit.
Yeah, his name was, we called him Big Stoop. He's a big guy. He was about 6'6", and he used to like to pick on all the American GI prisoners of war, and he was always looking for this radio, and the English prisoners of war were good at making radios so that we could get the information of the war every day, which we got daily. And he was looking for the radio, so he'd come in and have us take our mattresses, which were just sacks full of straw like you have in the water coolers, and he'd have us dump them over there out in the middle of the barracks in a field. And he was looking for the radio, which he never did find. And then he'd be mad, so he'd get a GI and just slap him across the ears and bust his eardrums. So it never happened to me, but it happened to some of them. So that was one part of it.
He was a pretty mean guy, but he found out what happened to him.
Yes, and then we found out that after the war, toward the end of the war there, they found him with his throat slit. So somebody got even.
And another thing that you would learn eventually was that Adolf Hitler, shortly before committing suicide, gave some orders to all his commanders.
Yes, just before he committed suicide, he ordered his commanders to kill all the prisoners of war, which, fortunately, they didn't.
Amen to that. You wouldn't be here, your three kids wouldn't be here, your seven grandkids wouldn't be here, and your seven great-grandchildren wouldn't
That's
be here.
That's right. That's right. They sure wouldn't be. So
tell me really quickly as we wrap things up here, when you were liberated, and I know that the German guards basically just disappeared and you guys knew you were on your own, what did that feel like after all that time, after three months and 600 miles, and what was that like?
Right there at the end, they found out that the English and Americans were advancing from the west. So they turned us around and headed us back east again. And I think we went about a half a mile or maybe a mile, and they stopped. And all the guards took off and went to this farmhouse. So we realized right there, we're liberated. So we just waited, and the British came up, and they didn't liberate us. I guess we got liberated by ourselves. But anyway, the British made us some tea, like British tea. They boil water, put some tea in it, put cream in it, and sugar. And that's not the way I like my tea, but we drank it anyway.
You weren't going to complain at that point.
No.
And a few months later, you would make it back to the States, a calmer ride across the Atlantic this time with Lady Liberty waiting for you, and eventually you'd make it back to Central California and meet up with your parents who had been waiting for so long. What was that like?
It was tremendous. I came from Sacramento on a Greyhound bus to Merced, and from Merced on a Moyer stage to the Dos Feliz Y, and they were there waiting for me when the bus arrived, and it was just tremendous. It's hard to describe, really.
An unforgettable moment for you.
Yes.
No. And I know that you've stayed active in your POW group. I know you've been back to Poland where the POW camp was.
Yes, I took my daughter with me, and there was 15 other POWs. And we met in, we went from Amsterdam to, what did I say it was? Norway. Norway. And we met all the other POWs there.
Uh-huh.
Got on a bus and went to Poland. And we were together for 16 days. And we've been friends ever since.
I imagine
It's hard to forget them.
Hard to forget going through something that intense
right.
and that
uh-huh.
extreme. And Rudy, we thank you for your service to our country. And for those at home who want to see the TV version of Rudy's story of service, hear some of these same stories, see what a good-looking young guy he was back in 1944 and 45, and see what stands at Stalag Luft 4 today. CBS 47 at 6 o'clock tonight. We'll have that TV story. Rudy, stick around. Maybe some of our callers will have some comments or questions for you in a few minutes at 490-5858 or toll-free 800-776-5858. Right now, let's bring in our other guest today. Every week, we talk about a book of the week, a volunteer of the week, and a website of the week. The book of the week, by the way, which you'll find at KMJ580.com, a link to that. It's called The 11th Man. It's about another man who was on that German death march, a man by the name of Robert Honeycutt, who's written a very short, easy read about that march called The 11th Man. I think you'll find it interesting. You can find that link on our website. Also there, you will find a link to the Dad's War website, which was created by Wesley Johnston of Clovis, who joins us now. And Wes, tell us why this came about. Your father was in the war and survived the war, but didn't talk about it too much. You never really knew what he had been through, right?
Well, I was only 7 years old when he died. He died in 1954 of kidney disease, so I never really found out a whole lot. I knew that he had frozen feet, he'd ridden in a half track, and he'd been in a place in Belgium called St. Vith, and that was about the sum of what I knew. And then in 1994, on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, Public Broadcasting had a program called The Fighter Pilot Story, where Quentin Anenson, who many people, I'm sure by now, have seen on the war.
Ben Burns, yeah.
Yeah. He produced this show. It was about 2.5 hours going through his entire time in service. And then he comes on at the end with his gray hair, and he says, you know, I made this so my children and my children's children would know, you know, what happened. And I thought to myself, you know, well, if my dad was still alive and he wanted to do something like this, what would it look like? And I thought the only way I'm ever going to find that out is to start doing the research myself. And that's how it began.
And where do you start? I imagine, you know, without ever having gotten into it before, it was probably kind of hard. And this was the infancy of the Internet. It's certainly not what it is today. So you can't find a bunch of links like someone can find your website now. How long did it take before you started to get some nuggets of what exactly he went through?
Well, my brother had been a career Army, and during that time, you know, he had come up with an address for the 7th Armored Division Association, and I began by calling there. And they had just had a trip in October of 94 over to Europe, and there was a list of guys. You know, I knew from my dad's discharge papers what battalion and what company he'd been in, and so I started calling the guys on who had gone on the tour, and they'd say, no, I didn't know your dad. And then this one guy in Tucson, I called him up, and I told him, I'm looking for anybody who knew my dad, and he was in 7th Armored, and he was from Chicago, and I forget what it was that Sam said, but it just gave me goosebumps, because he came back and he said something like, we had some hard times together. And he proceeded to tell me some of those hard times, and I was very pleased this past May to be in Holland, actually in Belgium as well, both Holland and Belgium, with Sam, who's the only remaining member of my dad's squad whose memory is still intact. And he showed me where they were. That was the highlight of my year for this year.
Oh, I can imagine. And you start out with those basic things you told us. You knew you'd been in a half track, you had frozen feet, et cetera, et cetera. What's the volume of how much you know about your dad now, and how fulfilling has that search, that quest been for you?
I'll never know everything. There's no way you can. But I know a tremendous amount. And I have a master's degree in history, and so I was not walking into this cold.
Right.
So I started, checking out the historical documents and finding after-action reports, morning reports, all sorts of different documents. And when I did go over there in December of 94, and I actually found foxholes still up on the hillside east of St. Vith, Belgium, where there'd been nothing between them and Berlin except Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And stood in those foxholes and thought, my God, these men fought for their lives in these holes in the ground. Nobody knows their names. And I decided at that point to write the history of my dad's battalion. And it's since expanded that I also have a website for the 7th Armored Division. And I have a team of volunteers who are actually putting documents out onto the internet. We have over 10,000 pages. I want to let that sink in, because that is a lot of pages that we have transcribed and put out onto the internet, and we're putting out more every single month. And that's still just a tiny drop in the bucket. But those records that we have out there for the 7th Armored Division are a very good example of what you know, if you're looking for your father's ancestry or your uncle or your grandfather, your brother, you know, whatever, that are the kinds of records that you can expect to find.
And I think that's a good example of strength in numbers and the potential that's out there, even now with more than 1,000 World War II veterans dying every day. If you have a veteran in your family, talk to him or her now. Get them to share that story with you. Encourage all your friends to do that. And if everyone does their part, by the time that all the World War II veterans are gone, we'll have saved a whole lot of history that otherwise would not have been saved. And that's what we've been trying to do through the TV series with Stories of Service, and now through this radio show, and obviously with 10,000 pages online of history of that 7th Armored Division. You've done a great job there. I want to ask you more about that and how people can use that website to make their own quests like yours. We need to get one more commercial break here, but when we come back, more with Wesley Johnston. And if you have a question or a comment, 490-5858 or 800-776-5858. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on this Sunday afternoon. We're with you every Sunday at 4 for an hour. And then, of course, you can catch the veteran that we feature on this program on TV, CBS 47 at 6 o'clock in Stories of Service. Today, that was Rudy Giannone. We just got a call from his sister, Carol, who said she heard stories from Rudy that she hadn't heard before. So, Carol, we are glad to provide that service, and we'll make sure you get a copy of his DVD after we get the TV version done and all that, too. We're also talking to Wesley Johnston, who, wanting to know what his father had been through — his dad died when he was just 7 years old in 1954, he set off on a quest to learn more about his father. Eventually, he did that, and that wasn't enough for him. You decided that if you were in that position, there were probably others in that position, and you put on the internet what's basically a tutorial for people who want to try to find out something about a relative who's no longer here, who was in World War II.
Yeah, I fell into a lot of potholes, and I realized, you know, other people don't need to fall into these same potholes, and so that's why I started this. It just seemed like I actually started out doing workshops as well, but I developed chronic fatigue and had to abandon that. So I've put the internet information out there. I can't do follow-up research. You know, there's 12 million veterans, and I can't help everybody out. I'm too busy dealing with my own dad's story. But I could at least put this much out there so that people could get a really good start, you know, and know where to go to find more.
So that Dad's War website, you can link to it by going to our website at kmj580.com. If your relative was in the 7th Armored Division, you're really hitting the jackpot, because that can take you right to that. And even if not, there's information here that will point you in the right direction and really help you find some valuable information. Obviously, if you have a relative who was in World War II who's still around, the best source is going to be going right to him or her and asking directly. And maybe, like in the case of Rudy, you'll find out something that you never heard before, as Rudy's sister Carol did today. We have a caller on the line at 490-5858 who wants to say hello to Rudy. I believe that's what Earl wants to do, right, Earl?
Yes, and I wanted to let him know that the 5th and grade schools in Dulles Palace, along with the American Legion, on November the 9th, is dedicating a memorial to all the Dulles Palace servicemen who have served in the service since the Civil War up to date.
And I believe Rudy's planning on being there, aren't you, Rudy?
I'll be there.
Okay, well, I'm trying to get a flyover right now from the Air National Guard for that dedication, which would be, I want them to fly over about 10:55 a.m.
Okay, Earl, and I'm taking my sister Carol and my niece Karen with me. And we'll be there about, say, approximately 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
That's November the 9th in Dos Palos.
November the 9th in Dos Palos.
All right, Earl.
Thanks,
okay.
Earl.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Talking about the flyover, maybe they could get one of the couple of B-17s that's still flying to come on out and fly over that.
But you don't get those around anymore. We had one here not too long ago. But you know what it costs to ride on one of those?
I know. It's pretty pricey. And if you ask me, anyone who actually flew on one during the war should have a chance to ride for free. But I think the government would have to intervene and create a subsidy to make that happen for everybody here in the Valley. Rudy, was there anything else that in the time that you've been listening to Wesley talk about his efforts in tracking down his dad's story, that as you thought back about your own experiences, was there anything else that you wanted to share with our listeners that you think it's really important they understand about World War II, what you did and what guys like you did?
Well, I don't know what else I could say. I was in the service for just about 3 years, and I enjoyed most of the time except the time that I was a prisoner of war. I had saved up $150 when I was at the air base in England, because if we would have got home that night, we would have had a pass to go to London, which I'd never got to go to London, and I lost $150 and never got it back.
And Stalag Luft 4 wasn't exactly Buckingham Palace.
No, it wasn't. It sure wasn't.
But I don't hear you complaining about the way everything worked out. You seem to be pretty
grateful. I'm a happy person. I've had a great life. I've had a great family. I worked for Kraft Foods for 37 years, and I raised three children, seven grandchildren, and seven and a half great-grandchildren. So
that's one on the way.
That's the one that's on the way.
And this Veterans Day, we'll see you in the parade again?
Oh, yes. November the 11th, we're going to have that big, huge parade in Fresno.
Biggest one on the West Coast.
The Veterans Parade, the largest on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. We're going to have over 8,000 people in that parade, and the U.S. Army are the honorees. And so we wish that everyone would come to that parade. I'm in charge of the POW float, which is not a float, it's a semi truck and trailer, and it's my job to get it all fixed up and be in a parade.
And it has a couple guard towers on it, ones they had
just
at
Stalag. Just like the guard towers that we had guarding us in Germany.
The memory.
I never remembrance.
That's right. I know the memory is still very sharp for you. Well, Rudy, thank you so much again for your service. Thanks for being here. And again, you can see the TV version of Rudy's story on CBS 47 tonight at 6 o'clock. We're running out of time here, but I encourage you to go to that, to go to KMJ580.com, link to Wesley Johnson's Dad's War website. And I know you're dealing with chronic fatigue, as you said, but I know that you're working as hard as anybody is, and we say Godspeed to you in your efforts to not only search out your dad's story, but in helping so many other people find the stories that they're looking after. Any maybe one nugget that you would throw out there to people as far as the most important thing they need to do to try to track down some info like that?
Well, the first thing you really need to find is discharge papers, and that'll tell you what unit he was in, his battalion and his company. When the men were given their discharge papers, they were told in no uncertain terms that they would never, ever be given a replacement for these. And so many men...
But that's not true. They can, and they can do it online even now. They can write a letter. We're out of time, though, so I have to cut you off there. I'm sorry. But thank you for listening to Hometown Heroes today.